I would be remiss if I did not thank you again for letting me be your guest today and for sharing in your special occasion. Thank you to the elders for inviting me, and thank you for everybody for the hospitality. Leah was in a youth group that I worked with, and Sharon and Marsha were part of one of my congregation, and somebody arranged that we could eat lunch together today. They home-cooked some stuff and had some pie that I'm not supposed to have, but my wife's not here, so I had a piece or two, and that's not going to be on the tape, right? Anyway, thank you so much, and then I love to see these young guys coming up. Austin and Reed did outstanding in their classes, and I had not had the privilege of hearing Mr. Oakley speak, and he did an outstanding job, and I had almost as soon sing praises with Chuck as anybody I know. I hope that I feel like the way he looks when I'm praising God, because you can tell that he's got a relationship with his father and with his brethren when he does that. If you have your Bibles, let's look at 1 Thessalonians 2. We've been talking about raising spiritually self-reliant children and hadn't actually got to that part yet. This is normally a 4-to-6 session kind of a series, and I made some modifications because I knew we'd have some of the college folks with us. But when you get down to the nitty-gritty of the book I mentioned this morning, Dr. Stephen Glenn, Raising Self-Reliant Children in a Self-Indulgent World, and borrowing on some of his stuff, and really what prompted me to write those series of essays on youth ministry was the simple fact that I was going into private practice. I started as a youth minister in the spring of 1980. I turned down a position on the high school wrestling team to work at a little church in Anniston, Alabama, and worked in youth ministry in some capacity till I went into private practice in 1998. Very small private practice in Huntsville as a therapist. I work mainly with marriage and family and kiddos. I have some special training in trauma protocol, EMDR, and rapid resolution therapy, and a few little things like that. But I thought if I give up the office at the building and don't have the title youth minister anymore, they may not worry about what I thought about youth ministry. So I thought I'd put some things down and wrote these little series of essays and got permission from Dr. Glenn to use some of his terminology. In his book, he talks about the significant seven. Now, we'll only talk about three of the significant seven in our lesson tonight, so you didn't miss anything. We're only going to do three of them. Dr. Glenn says there must be three perceptions: I'm capable, I'm significant, and my choices affect my outcomes. And then there must be four skill levels: interpersonal skills, intrapersonal skills, systemic skills, and judgmental skills. When children learn to process their own emotions, learn to deal with who they are, their perceptions, their feelings, then they learn to deal with the feelings and perceptions of other people, and then they learn how to operate in a system. You're not always going to be first. Your artwork's not always going to be on the refrigerator. You're not always going to get the trophy. And then judgmental skills is how we make decisions based on values, not how we make decisions based on rules. But the part I wanted to talk about was these three perceptions. And the reason I like those three perceptions, the reason they resonated with me, is if you look at a parenting passage in the New Testament, and this is really a non-traditional parenting passage, because it's not the go-to passage in Colossians or the go-to passage in Ephesians 6. This is where Paul makes an assumption about the functions of a parent. And although it's not his message, he gives this gold mine of information about parenting, and it's from an inspired standpoint. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 10. And you are witnesses, and God also, how devoutly, justly, and blamelessly we behaved ourselves among you who believe. And as you know, we exhorted and comforted and charged or urged every one of you, as a father does his own children, that you should walk worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. So Paul, as he's talking to his audience, says, you've got to make record of, you've got to acknowledge our conduct among you. First thing he says is that when we were with you, we behaved ourselves rightly, justly, and devoutly. Sometimes that's fair, innocent, and holy. Sometimes that means blameless. It's not about perfection as much as it's about consistency. And the first thing Paul said is, as we were parenting you, as we were influencing you, you've got to notice that our behavior was consistent. The number one predictor of at-risk behavior in students, and I'm talking spiritually at-risk behavior, failure to thrive, failure to hang on to your faith, failure to be evangelistic, or even failure to become a faithful member of the church. The number one predictor of at-risk behavior in children is this question. Sit down with an adolescent or a pre-adolescent and ask this question. Do your parents profess things in public that they do not practice in private? And if a student answers that in the affirmative, you've got a 95% chance of having a student with spiritually at-risk behavior. Basically, what it's saying is that our students watch us. The number one influence on a student's spiritual development is their parents. The number two influence on a student's spiritual development is the other adults that they're exposed to in the church. That's why youth ministry is making a big move toward family-based ministry. Not where you isolate the kids over there by themselves, but you involve the kids with lots of other kids. It's the idea, my role at Meridianville, they call me the intergenerational minister. What that means is I'm too young to work with the senior citizens and I'm too old to work with the kids. How I define that is we're trying to avoid the Mickey Mouse church. A circle of kids, a circle of adults, a circle of senior citizens, and that makes the Mickey Mouse symbol, and we want those circles to overlap. We want those students exposed to mature Christian adults. In the book Sticky Faith, and why I bought the book Sticky Faith thinking it was about Spider-Man becoming a Christian, I was disappointed. But anyway, it's a good study by the Fuller Youth Institute that Sticky Faith says if a student has 5 mature Christians in their lives, they will develop a more mature faith. So the idea of the isolated youth group is going to be out of fashion very soon as we understand why we're losing our kids. And the influence is, what do we see from the consistency of our adults? Now, that's not to say that if a student doesn't have faithful parents, they can't become Christians. In my experience personally, and in some of these guys, you sit down and listen to them tell victory stories. A student can come to church in spite of their parents. If they have parents who do this and say, I don't want any part of your religion, I don't want any part of that church, you can be active if you want to, but I'll not support it. They'll have to come get you, they'll have to bring you home, they'll have to pay. Students can do that. I've had several students in my career who have come to church with a grandparent or with no parent, and they got surrogate parents at church. It's been my experience that when children have families that are involved and the parents say, come and go to church with us and we will worship and grow and praise God, children can handle that. Children can handle this. Children can handle this. What children do not tolerate is this. And when they get that mixed message, and when the parents do not behave devoutly, justly, and blamelessly, that's when they fail to thrive. That's when they say, well, what you're teaching is not real. What you're teaching is not authentic. And they're influenced negatively by that. So the first thing in raising spiritually self-reliant children is we've got to have our act together. We can't ask them to be different than we're demonstrating. We can't ask him to do different than what we're promoting. And so we've got to be consistent. The second thing he says is, you notice that we encouraged, we comforted, and we urged you as a father does his own children. Now that's the parenting part. The functions of a father in Paul's mind was to encourage, comfort, and urge. By the way, when you encourage somebody, and all these words are very similar to the word parakletos. They all have part of that word from Greek in them. When you encourage someone, you are asking them to be involved with you in some kind of service and some kind of act. Teaching our children that they are not consumers in the world, teaching them that they are not consumers in the church, but they are contributors, makes our students strong. Contrary to the Harry Potter books, there's no such thing as a house elf. Everything that gets done in your house gets done by a human. If the laundry gets folded, the grass gets cut, the dishes get cleaned, or something gets cooked, somebody did it, and you should have a part in it. Contrary to some of our mentality, if it happens in a church building, it's done by a human. And if you use the building, you should help clean it up. And if you ride the van, you should help make sure that the upholstery is taken care of. And you should be involved in the mission trips and the deacons' projects and cleaning up the grounds. Students are not here simply as consumers. We must encourage them to partake with us in the functions that we undertake. In the latter part of the book of Acts, there's a shipwreck story. And Paul and the 300 plus people wash ashore on this island, and the natives build a fire because it's cold and it's raining. And Paul brings a bundle of sticks to this fire. And as he places the sticks in the fire, a viper comes out and fastens to his hand. And it makes a great Vacation Bible School skit. We've all seen the overenthusiastic deacon beat a rubber snake almost to the terror of the children. That's not the point of that story. The point of the story is Paul is placing wood on a fire he didn't build. Why? Because Paul wants the warmth of that fire to continue. And when we teach our children, you didn't start this congregation. There was a building different than this one 5 years ago. There was a building different from that 25 years ago. And if you want it to continue, you've got to bring some sticks to a fire you didn't start. And we must encourage our students to partake with us, to be involved with us, and to participate at their level. Everybody can't do the same function, but all of us have a function. What's the most important part of your car? If you're a teenage girl, it's the pedal on the left called the brake. We could debate car theory. We could talk about drive shafts and injectors and universal joints. But if you're driving down the road and you get a pop-up thunderstorm and you don't have a $7 piece of rubber that does this, you'll park that car. Because the most vital part of that car is the part that's not working when you need it to. And our young people have to learn they're a vital part of the congregation in their participation, in their attendance, in their contribution of either time, energy, and even money is expected from them as they are members of the body. And there's no such thing as auditing the church. You come here because you are a member of the body. And as parents and as adults, we encourage the young people, and actually we encourage each other. If you're not a parent, your function in the church is the same as a parent's function, to encourage, comfort, and urge other people. Now, when I encourage you, I instill in you the idea that I am capable. Stephen Glenn's first premise, Paul's first premise, is I'm going to encourage you to be involved in something. And taking a little bit of liberty with the word, but to encourage is simply that, to instill courage into someone. When we were growing up, we rented a little house. It was at the end of a long driveway. 41 yards long. I measured it one time to time myself running it. It ended at a big dirt field with a big bank, and on both sides, the little property sloped off and dropped off into these dark pine thickets. We had some dogs. My brother had a dog. I had a dog. And my dad had a dog, so they all stayed in this area. My job was to water the dogs. Water weighs 8 pounds to the gallon. I had three dogs to water, so we had these big 5 gallon buckets. I haven't always been this tall. And if you carry a 5 gallon bucket with a handle full of water and you're not this tall, it'll bump on the ground. It was hard work to water those silly dogs. And as a child, I would sort of delay watering the dogs. I could get distracted and do other things. Dad would come in from work and we'd be eating supper, and he'd put his fork down and go, "Did you water the dogs?" "No, sir, I didn't. We need to get it done." Now, instead of just watering the dogs, I had to go water the dogs in the dark. And you walk out that yard, and you drop off that hill, and when you drop off that hill, it's dark in a pine thicket. And you couldn't see the house, and you couldn't see the lights of the house. You may not be familiar in Tennessee with the pine tree monster. They're prolific in Alabama. They live in pine trees. The guy who names them is a genius. Pine tree monsters have dinosaur vision. If you move very fast, they can see you. So you have to move very, very slow so they won't notice you. And if you're walking out of that pine thicket and one breathes on the back of your neck and you turn around, he will consume you. So you've got to walk down there and water those dogs and never look in those trees, but you can hear them moving around up there. And you've got to walk back to that house, soldier straight, and never let your eyes go behind you. Terrified of the dark. Terrified of the pine tree monster. But it's my job to go down there and water those dogs. And my dad wouldn't absolve me from my responsibility. It was my task, my job. I'd go down there and water those dogs, and I could feel it crawling up the back of my neck, and I'd walk back, and just about the time my little head would pop that hill, I'd see my dad. He smoked in those days. He leaned back up against the porch on that old yellow porch light with a cigarette in his hands. Pine tree monsters are terrified of my dad. He never called me a coward. He never asked me, was I afraid? He never teased me about my fears. He just gave me the courage to go do what was expected of me to do. I spend an incredible amount of time in the dark. I'm a chaplain with a SWAT team. We live in the dark. We train on training nights. I hide in abandoned buildings in the dark. If you turn a flashlight on, those snipers will see you. Before my eyes started fading a little bit, I'd go an entire hunting season, never turn my flashlight on in the dark. I'm very comfortable walking through the woods in the dark and the moonlight, navigating on the silhouette of the trees. I got that courage from Dad. A dad who refused to let me off the hook, and a dad who refused to belittle and shame me, but a dad who simply said, you've got a job to do, and I will give you the courage to do what is right. Parents, our job with our young people is to bring them to church, to encourage them to be here, to encourage them to participate. At some point, you may say, well, you know, I'm not going to force my kids to go to church. I get that. I think you need to explain it to your young people this way. This is not about you. It's not about me. It's about me and God. You're a dependent in my house. And one day I will have to stand before God and say, I fed them, I clothed them, I outfitted them, and I let them not come to your house and worship. I'm going to bring you what you do while you're here is between you and God. But I'm going to give you the courage to do what is right. Paul said, as your witnesses, as a parent, we encouraged you. Second thing he said we did was we comforted you. Comfort is responding to people who are in crisis. Comfort is responding to people when they go through transitions. Comfort is being able to respond to them when they get into these highly charged emotional states that teenagers go into. If encourage is I am capable, comfort means I am significant. And teaching significance in the church is something that we've not done a good job with. Mark Sanborn says that if you're a member of an organization, you must receive three things from that organization: attention, belonging, and support. Attention is simply, I know who you are. I know some things about you. I know who your children are. I know what your interests are. Belonging means we want you to feel like that you've got a place. You've got a partnership. You've got ownership here. And support means if something good happens, we'll celebrate with you. And if something bad happens, we will be there to comfort you. We'll be there to deal with you. A pretty simple, you know, counseling 101 with teenagers is that what we did this morning about the cognitive therapy. What happened? What does it mean to you? And does it mean what you think it means? It's important to instill into our young people that your emotions are God-given. When your emotions are handled properly, you end up with balance and harmony. When you have an emotional situation, it produces distress, destruction, or dysfunction, then something's going on with your emotional system. Young people, the most important thing to remember about your emotions is your emotions are not instruction. Your emotions are simply information. The difference between information is instruction. My wife and I were traveling back and forth from Arkansas, and we stopped at a little place, and I stayed inside too long, came outside. She said, what took you so long? I said, well, they had a sign that said clean restrooms, and so I did. The difference between information, the restrooms are clean, and instructions, clean the restrooms, is very, very important. When you get an emotional signal, young people, that's not telling you to do something. It's just telling you something. A lot of times it's a warning sign. A lot of times it's a danger sign. A lot of times it's an alert sign. It's your emotional system giving you information to process a request. But when we let our emotions drive the bus rather than let our intellect drive the bus, we get in real, real trouble. The easiest thing, parents, is to ask your young people, what do you feel and what do you know? And to the degree that your feelings and your facts overlap, you're making good decisions. And if you're acting on only feelings or only facts, you're probably not going to make a good decision. But what you feel and what you know, when they overlap, that's a good way to intervene. And sometimes intervention with children in crisis is not about solving a problem. John Gottman talks about emotion coaching, where you recognize the validity of the emotion, and you say, now that you've had this emotion, What can we do to solve the problem? Some problems are unsolvable, so you either give empathy or you give empowerment. In John chapter 11, Jesus is given a message. The message is, hey, your friend Lazarus is sick. Jesus responds in John chapter 11 by saying, well, this sickness is not unto death. Does that indicate to you that Jesus knows how this story is going to end? They sent him a message later that says, Lazarus is dead. Jesus says, hey, we're going to see Lazarus, and I'm glad I wasn't there for your sakes that God may be glorified. Do you believe that this indicates Jesus knows how this story is going to end? Jesus announces to his disciples, hey, our friend Lazarus is sleeping, and I'm going to wake him up. The disciples thought he meant taking rest and sleep, and Jesus plainly told them he's dead, and I'm glad I wasn't there because we're going to go glorify God. Do you believe that indicates how Jesus knows how this story is going to end? Jesus gets to town. Martha comes out and says, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't be dead. And Jesus says, your brother will live again. She says, I know my brother will live again at the resurrection. Jesus says, I am the resurrection. Do you believe that Jesus knows how this story is going to end? Absolutely. Then explain John 11:35. Jesus wept. Well, people try to tell me that Jesus wept because of the unbelief of the Jews, or Jesus wept for some... Jesus cried with those people because they were crying. And even though he knew, if you'll pardon my Alabama English, that he was going to bust that funeral wide open, even though he knew that it was all going to be better, he didn't take the time to tell them. He took the time to weep with them. And that little seventh grade girl comes home and says, Mama, that boy that I'm going with, and we're not old enough to go anywhere, quit going with me, so now we can't go the places we couldn't go in the first place. And her little heart's broke. You can tell her statistically you'll be in 8 major relationships. 60% of you will be engaged at least one time before you're married. Thank goodness you got rid of the loser. Or you can put her in your lap and say, honey, I'm sorry, your heart's broken. I'm sorry your self-esteem is damaged. I'm sorry you feel like you've been rejected. Sometimes crisis intervention is not about solving the problem, but about responding to the hurt. Sometimes crisis intervention is letting the person know that you are important enough to me that I'll attune and see the world from your perspective. Gentlemen, it's a pretty good skill with your wives too. You don't necessarily have to agree or validate with what they're saying. You just have to let them know you understand what they're saying. Pretty simple little exercise in attunement. I'm going to count to three. When I do, please point to your right. 1, 2, 3. Everybody in the room disagrees with me. That's a problem. Let's do this. If you were standing where I'm standing, facing the direction I'm facing, point to my right. All you did was put yourself in my position and change your perception. Sometimes dealing with your spouse, gentlemen, is as simply as, if this were that important to me, how would I feel? If I felt this much about that, how would I feel? And especially put yourself in the position of a teenager who's guilty of all or nothing thinking, who has a highly charged emotional brain, and when they get into crisis, don't look at it from your logical adult standpoint. Look at it from that child standpoint. Because trauma can be defined by lots of different ways, gives implicit meanings to things. And just learning how to say, I love you, you're important to me, and it hurts me to see you hurt. Job's three friends did a good job when they showed up at his house and sat for 7 days and didn't say a word. It's when they opened their mouth, they ruined the picture. Learn to do crisis intervention. So the three things that parents should do: encourage, comfort, I'm capable, I'm significant, and then urge. This word is almost like training. It's a very close word to discipline. It fits in with Stephen Glenn's model, or Stephen Glenn's model fits this, I think, is really the way it works, is that you teach students that you are responsible and your choices influence your outcomes. This is where we get into discipline. This is where we get into the place where we teach our students that there is some accountability. All punishment is not discipline. All discipline is not punishment. Discipline is defined as putting stress into a relationship so the result is growth. We make choices with our children to influence the choices they make so that they experience some stress, and the end product of that stress is growth. Let me state it another way, maybe. All human behavior is reward motivated. I do what I do the way I do it because it works for me on some level. I usually say all human behavior is reward motivated. I do what I do because it gets me something I want. I've changed it now to it gets me something I want or it gets me something I value. People who are values driven are mature. People who are want driven are immature. So when you're dealing with your students, you've got to understand they act the way they act and they do what they do because it gets them a reward that they like. When my behavior cost me more than it cost you, I'll change my behavior. To state that another way, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. But you can put salt in the oats. And if those oats are salty, you're not going to have to argue with that horse about water. You don't have to fight every day. Drink your water, drink your water. If the oats are salty, he will ask you for water. You won't have to force him to get water. So when we learn the discipline, that it's not some overbearing punishment, it's not this hard-fisted, autocratic, authoritarian, but it's the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And that's what the word admonition means. It means a counsel, an advice, a warning, a caution, so that the students get to see that they have some power in their lives. When we do this, and we do it on a consistent basis, and by the way, the consistency in discipline has to have three components. It must have immediacy, it must have severity, and it must have consistency. The immediacy is that if I have a rule and you break the rule, we've got to respond to that rule every single time. A rule that is only enforced every now and then is not really an effective rule. The reason you speed is because you can speed and not get caught every time. The reason you speed is because you can speed and not get caught every time, and the one time they do catch you, you can go to driving school and not have to pay that ticket. The reason we speed is because we don't get caught every time. It's not that bad a punishment, and it's not severe enough. It's not immediate, it's not severe, and it's not consistent. If the next time you got caught speeding, they brought you out of the car and they zapped you with a taser, and that taser implanted a little thing in your hip that the next time that speedometer needle went above what's posted, it would shock you with about 30,000 volts. You'd sell that high-powered car and get you a smart car, and you'd put along like a good law-abiding citizen. But the fact that we don't get those responses means that we don't have to worry about it. When you tell your child not to do something and they do it and it doesn't cost them, they will find out that you don't mean what you say. My hardest struggle in self-control is not to throw business cards over the aisle at Walmart. Now, Johnny, Mommy said she's... No, by the time you have to remind Johnny what Mommy said, Johnny already doesn't believe Mommy. Immediacy, severity, and consistency. In fact, if you read Hebrews chapter 12, in the middle of that section, the Hebrew writer says we should view suffering in the same way we view discipline. That God allows us to suffer in the same way that a father disciplines a child. That a father who loves his child will discipline his child. When you discipline your child, it breeds respect. And if we have a rule for our children and we don't back it up in an attempt to try to be their friends, your children have friends. The people they're friends with won't be their friends in 4 years. They'll leave high school and go to college. Your children don't need more friends. They need somebody to respect. It's not your job to make your children happy. It's your job to teach your children the hard lessons of life so they can be self-reliant. When Lonnie Beth was little, and I got blamed for a lot of this stuff, but really my wife is kind of stubborn. I began training with the police in 92. Training night back in those days was from 6 to 2. So I'd leave the office and go work out with the guys, and we'd do whatever we were going to do. And if I came in on a training night and Jackie was up, Jackie was hurt. That's the same night she played volleyball and softball. And I came in on two separate occasions. She'd broken a leg and broken an ankle. And so I came in one Tuesday night, and Jackie's sitting there on the couch. I said, "Honey, are you hurt?" She goes, "No, it's the baby." I said, "Is the baby hurt?" She goes, "No, no, no." She said, "We went to a thing at church, one of those ladies' functions where you eat. And She said as we were going through the line, Lonnie Beth kept getting these oversized portions. Lonnie Beth's about three at the time. So she's getting these oversized portions, and Jackie's putting it back, and there's kind of this battle of wills. And said, finally, Lonnie Beth got over here to this cake thing and got this piece of cake that would choke Conan the Barbarian. And Jackie, being exasperated, said, if you get that, you will eat it. And Jackie goes, sits down at the ladies' table. Lonnie Beth sits down at the kids' table, takes one little spoonful of cake, gets up, toddles over to the trash can, gets up on her little tippy toes, and drops it in. Jackie gets up, gets it out, puts it back on the plate. Says, I've got a key. We'll be here till it's gone. A little steady string of little girls. Miss Jones, there's invisible things called germs. I'm a science teacher. Back off. So she said, I made her eat the cake. I said, well, she called you bluff. I think maybe you did the right thing. We go to bed about 3:30. I hear this noise coming from the other end of the house. I put my sweatpants on, go sit down in the hall, little bathroom doors open, lights are on. She's on those little tippy toes, leaned over the porcelain porch, looking under the hood. I said, baby, what's wrong? Daddy, I'm sick. Sweetheart, why are you sick? Mama made me eat garbage cake. Why did Mama make you eat garbage cake? I did not obey. I thought she would spank me. At 3 years old, this demonic spawn had done the math and said, you know what? You give me three licks, but I ain't eating that cake. Get you some of that. And her mom said, what I said was, you will eat the cake. Welcome to having a strong-willed child. But if you don't teach your children that your word means something, and grounded means grounded. Grounded means you don't play sports. Grounded means you don't go to work. Grounded means you miss your shot on the team. If you misuse that cell phone, you put it in the blender. The U.S. Constitution does not protect your rights to search and seizure. I can look at anything you own anytime I pay the bill on it, and if you don't like those rules, you cannot have one. Well, somehow we've got this idea that children can dictate what we do or what we say or how we do it, and if you don't build that kind of respect in an attempt to try to be your children's friend, you get a very bad result. And this may be resting the scriptures, and then you'll have to pardon me if it is. But you look at the story of the prodigal son. The prodigal son essentially tells his father, I want my inheritance and I want to run away. And the father cashes him out and lets him go. The prodigal son runs out of money, runs out of friends, and ends up in a pig pen. And in his pig pen moment, when his behavior cost him more than it cost everybody else, when the prodigal son woke up and came to himself, he said, I'll go home and ask Dad if I can be a servant. And when he came home asking his dad to be a servant, his sonship was reinstated without hesitation. Compare that to the story of Absalom. Absalom murders a half-brother. David grounds him, banishes him from the kingdom. He gets conned by Joab and says, okay, Absalom can come back to Jerusalem. He just can't see my face. So now, are you grounded or are you not grounded? Are you banished or are you not banished? Absalom has a chariot, 50 men to run before him, and he sits at the gate and he starts seducing the people. And at some point, Absalom declares a rebellion and makes a run for the palace. David is the undefeated warrior king of Israel. And he exits Jerusalem crying and barefooted and goes up to the ascent of the Mount of Olives. Now, please remember that David is surrounded by a personal bodyguard of people who were probably Philistines and followed him back from Gath. And as David is going out of the city, a guy named Shemaiah is throwing rocks at him and cursing him. And one of David's right-hand men says, would you like me to go bring you his head? Now, I'm not sure how taking somebody's head off is in your top five conflict resolution strategies. But these guys were tough. These guys were unbelievably harsh men. And yet, if that's the first thing you do to a guy throwing rocks, what should be done to a kid who's made a run at the throne? And yet David tells his generals, when it comes time to actually go to war, deal gently with the young man Absalom for my sake. Now, which is it, David? Is he rebellious? Is he a traitor? Is he trying to take the kingdom? Or are you giving it to him? And Absalom gets caught in an oak tree. And Joab finds him. And when Joab finds him, he puts three darts or three javelins in him. And I assume that's a pretty good pattern spread. And Joab says, I've got the backbone to do what the king won't do. In my mind, you've got two scenarios when you've got a rebellious child. You let him end up in the pig pen, and it's a coin toss as to whether he'll wake up and come home, or I guarantee you he will meet a Joab. It may be a third shift officer. It may be his drug dealer. It may be on the final day of judgment. You don't know how the pig pen will turn out. He may be too stubborn to admit he's wrong, but at least he's got a chance. But if you don't put some pig pen consequences in his life, I guarantee you, I promise you, he's got a Joab encounter. And you don't want him to meet Joab. You want him to end up in the pig pen so that they might wake up and come to their senses. Paul says you are witnesses, and God also, how devoutly, justly, and blamelessly we behaved ourselves among you. And you know that we encouraged, we comforted, and we urged you, as a father does his own children, that you walk worthy of God, who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. Folks, if we encourage, comfort, and urge, and it's not with a spiritual emphasis, if we encourage, comfort, and urge, and it's about being successful in business, or it's about being successful in athletics, or it's about anything other than walking worthy of God who calls us into his kingdom, we failed our children, and we failed as parents. Because when these children leave us, and we take them to a university, and we leave them, who are they going to be? And that depends on how much encouragement, comfort, and urging we've given them from a biblical standpoint. I'm capable. I'm significant. And my choices will affect my outcomes. And letting them be in charge of their choices and us being in charge of the outcomes. I pray that this has been a practical lesson. I pray that this has been something that will help you as you think about raising spiritually self-reliant children. My question tonight is, what is your relationship, not with your children, but with your Father? Are you walking worthy of the kingdom? Are you walking worthy of your Father who calls you into his kingdom? If you're not a baptized believer, you're not a New Testament Christian, you are an alienated, isolated son from your Father. If you haven't by faith, repentance, confession, and baptism died to self and been buried to rise a new life, you're still buried and in sin and without hope. And it may be that at some point in your life you've been baptized. It may be at some point that you've been a Christian, but you've not done the things that you should be doing to walk worthy of the kingdom. You can't be a good parent unless your walk with God is consistent. And you can't be a successful student unless your walk with God is consistent. If you're not a Christian, the invitation is open to you to come forward. If you are a Christian and need our prayers or our support or our encouragement, we'll study with you, we'll pray with you, we'll baptize you. Whatever your spiritual need is, your Father wants you to walk worthy of the kingdom. Come home tonight while we stand and while we sing.